Okay, we are on week two of a series called Asking for a Friend, where we are looking at seven of the toughest questions that people will ask Christians about their faith. Maybe questions you've been asked, and we're hoping to inform and equip Christians to be able to have thoughtful conversations about these issues. These are seven of the questions that are probably some of the most common ones, and really questions that we should have somewhat of a thoughtful answer to, so that we can engage in dialogue with people who are curious about God. Last week, we started with the basic question, does God exist? Kind of the basic idea that enables us to begin to talk about other things, about who God is and how God is revealed in Jesus Christ. But I encourage you, if you missed it, to listen online. Go to betheltab.ca to listen, or we have our podcast on iTunes as well. And you can look at that. So today is actually a bit of a continuation of that topic, where we're looking at, not as we did last week, the arguments for God's existence, the clues that we see in the universe for his existence, but now we're looking at a major argument against God's existence, and that comes from the realm of science. And the question we're asking today is this: has science disproved God? In a world of reason and rationale, in a world where science is uncovering the mysteries of the universe more and more each day, is there any room for God anymore? Is there any room for him in the picture? Is there any room for religious belief? Doesn't a scientific worldview exclude God? And isn't there a war between people of faith and people of science? Now, I grew up in my house watching Star Trek. Anybody else? Any Trekkies out there? You bunch of nerds, right? We grew up watching Star Trek. My mom was a bit of a Trekkie, so I was introduced to the various captains of the various starships in the Star Trek universe. And in fact, I continue to enjoy the sci-fi genre. Something about out in space and the mysteries of the galaxies that kind of intrigues my imagination, and something about speculation about the future and what the world will look like and what kind of technological advances will happen. Those things are just kind of interesting to me. Will we one day be able to travel through the stars at warp speed? Will we one day be able to beam long distances in an instant just by asking Scotty to beam us up? Are these things actually going to be possible? I find it kind of fascinating. The one thing I know will never be possible, no matter how far in the future, no matter how advanced technology gets, I know there will never be a cure for baldness. Jean-Luc Picard, the captain of the Federation Starship Enterprise, 800 years in the future, is completely bald. I see them curing brain cancer with an LED light on that show, but baldness is still an intergalactic curse, right? There is no hope for us gentlemen who are bald or thinning, so don't hold out any. We'll just accept our plight. But anyways, what the thing Star Trek does is they try to predict what will happen in the future, what it will be like technologically, but not just technologically, socially. And you see in this Star Trek universe, you see some interesting things that they have kind of portrayed about the human race. The Earth has formed itself into a single government. So there's no more conflict between nations. There's no more wars. The entire human race is global. There's no longer any crime. It's only those pesky Klingons and Kardashians who are causing trouble in the universe. You know, there was one episode where I remember them claiming that there's just zero crime. It's just, you know, so they're trying to spread the love throughout the rest of the stars. There was another episode that I watched where one character was very surprised to encounter an advanced species who actually had religious belief. Because he said, and this is a paraphrase, he said, long ago on Earth, science disproved all religions. And so this is the world that Star Trek is creating, to just say, this advancement of technology, the advancement of human reason and thought, we're eventually going to solve all our problems through science and technology and reason, and eventually we'll have this utopian dream, we'll be able to spread our view of life throughout the whole universe. This is the world that it's trying to create. This was the prevailing view, actually, through the first half of the 20th century. We believed, as humanity, as science improved, as we began to use our reason and intellect in different ways, we believed that eventually we'd be able to create this utopian dream where we would solve all our problems through advanced science and technology. But this world has not come through for us. We have more technology today than we ever dreamed possible 100 years ago, and many of the devices that Star Trek predicted have actually come into reality, but we're realizing that they're actually creating just as many problems as they fix. In the world today, we have more violence than we've ever had in history. We have more warfare than ever. There's more human slavery than ever before. Science and technology are great. They solve a ton of problems, and they're lots of fun. We have our smartphones, which give us access to more information than we dreamed just from our pocket. But we're also realizing that screen addiction is a very real thing, and it's being tied to depression in our kids. So all of the problems that our screens are fixing are actually causing even more problems. We're not happier with these things. We're actually more depressed and emotionally distraught. So the worlds of academia and philosophy and science and theology are recognizing afresh that science is not the answer to all things. Science is wonderful and helpful. Technology is wonderful and helpful, but there's more going on in the world than that can be fixed by these things. So should Christians be opposed to science? Should we fear scientific discoveries or scientific thought? Should we fight against science? Not at all. We should not at all. In fact, modern science grew out of the garden of Christianity. Christianity and its beliefs actually built a foundation for people to pursue scientific endeavors. Let me read a portion of scripture that I also read last week, but add another point of application. Romans 1:20 says, "Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse." So this world is talking about God's creative order expresses his invisible qualities. It tells us something about who he is, and that something in the nature that he created enables us to know him more. But it also tells us that God has created an orderly universe in such a way that it enables us to deduce truths from it. There's order, and there's laws, and there's things that we can actually look at and understand. In fact, creation is inviting us to study it. The Bible teaches us that God created the world with laws and regularity, with order. The whole Bible talks about a God who comes into chaos and produces order. He comes into darkness and produces light. And believing in an orderly universe is a necessary and foundational belief if you want to practice science. If a universe was not governed by law, there's no way to make predictable observations, which is the foundation of scientific study. And there's really no other religious worldview in the ancient world that actually gave this sort of foundation. So the earliest scientists were Christians who believed in a world that had law and order to it because there was a God who had law and order to him. And so they studied the world, not just as a means to understand the world, but also as a means to understand the God who was behind it all. So it has been said that God has authored two books. He has given us the Bible, but he's also given us creation. And as we study both of his books, we will come to a deeper understanding of who he is. Psalm 19, verse 1 and 2 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge." So creation itself is actually declaring truth and knowledge about God. We can discern something about him by understanding his creation. Genesis 1 talks about God speaking creation into existence. God said, "Let there be light." God said, "Let there be fish, let there be sky, let there be oceans." And now if creation really was spoken into existence, then creation itself must be a form of God's communication to humanity. God is speaking to us through what he has created. And if we're listening, and you could argue science is part of what it means to listen to God's voice in creation, then we're going to learn something about God from creation. So when we read both of these books that God gave us, they're not going to contradict each other. There have been times in history where they have helped to understand each other. Often the Bible helps us understand what we're learning in science, and sometimes the science helps us understand tricky parts of the Bible. And they're not going to contradict each other. They're going to help us understand God in greater degrees. But for some reason, we have built this false dilemma. We've built this dilemma to say, if you are a person of faith, you can't be a person of science. And if you're a person of science, you can't be a person of faith. And what we've done is we've given two options and said, these are the only options. That's what they call in philosophy a false dilemma. In fact, these two can be compatible and work together, and there are more than two options in this argument. So Alistair McGrath, who is an Oxford professor and a Christian, he says this, "The idea that science and religion are in perpetual conflict is no longer taken seriously by any major historian of science. One of the last remaining bastions of atheism which survives only at the popular level, namely the myth that an atheistic fact-based science is permanently at war with a faith-based religion." And the issue that kind of gets missed in all this dialogue is the fact that science could actually never possibly provide us with a conclusive argument against the existence of God. Because the realm of science exists only in the natural universe, only within the laws of physics, only within the closed system of creation. Whereas we have a God who sits outside of the laws of physics and outside the closed system of creation. So even if we discerned every mystery in this known universe, it could never touch the question of whether or not he exists. This is a God who cannot be put into a test tube and have experiments done on him and have analysis done on him. So Stephen Jay Gould, who is maybe the most celebrated atheist, evolutionary biologist, paleontologist, and historian of science, he, with obvious fatigue in his voice, said this, "To say it for my colleagues for the umpteenth millionth time, science simply cannot, by its legitimate methods, adjudicate the issue of God's possible superintendence of nature. We neither affirm nor deny it. We simply cannot comment on it as scientists." He's saying science is not what we use to ask questions about whether or not God exists. Science is what we use to just look at the universe and try to understand it. But of course, we also know that if God did create the universe, then we will learn something about him as we practice science. Now, a lot of modern atheists will say that the only way to discover any truth is to use the scientific process. Any other means of discovering truth are invalid. And the example that's given for this is it's kind of like the man who lost his keys on a dark street, and he only looked under the light of a street lamp to find them. And when he was asked, "Why are you only looking under the street lamp?" he said, "Well, the light is better over here." Right? So what he's doing, the keys could be anywhere on the street, but he's saying, "I'm only going to use my power of sight to find these, and I can only do that under this street lamp." He's undervaluing other senses or other tools that can be used to find his keys. So science is one of the tools that we use to discern truth, but there's much more to the universe than what science can tell us. So what's the real problem? Where does this clash of worldviews come from? It is not between science and faith, but faith comes into conflict with the philosophical conclusions that are made based on certain brands of science. In fact, Alvin Plantinga kind of changes the dialogue. He puts the challenge in two other areas, leaving faith out of it. He says, "Many hold that there is a conflict between science and religion. The truth of the matter is that the conflict is between science and naturalism, not between science and belief in God." So he's saying the conflict is not science and faith or science and religion, but he's saying there's this philosophical idea of naturalism, and that is where science comes and has struggles with. So let me kind of get it. There's terms here, and that's why, you know, take notes, re-listen on the podcast. There's lots of different quotes in this sermon series. So we have to kind of understand now, what is this idea of naturalism? It's the philosophical position that only natural laws and forces operate in the universe. Okay, so if you have this system of the universe, only natural things occur. There is no supernatural force. There is no deity behind anything. There is nothing outside of the universe that intervenes in any way. Only natural forces exist in our universe. That is what naturalism is. So Plantinga says this is actually at odds with science. And this is the summary statement. "Given naturalism," says Plantinga, "it is illogical to believe in logic." Okay? Given naturalism, it is illogical to believe in logic. Who is one of the favorite Star Trek characters of all times? You know, Nimoy, epic eyebrows, pointy ears, lover of all things logic. It was Spock. And he and his race of Vulcans learned to suppress all emotions and make all of their decisions based on pure logic. Well, the big question for Spock is, how does he know that his logic is logical? How does he know that logic works? Okay, I need to set this up for you, okay? I got to set this up. Okay, this is going to take a minute, but we're going to get there. So we have to back up. Last week, we talked about this truth. Theologians, philosophers, scientists, naturalists all agree that belief in the divine is 100% natural. It's wired in humanity. Every human culture throughout all time has had some sort of belief in the divine and in the supernatural. So when you go to naturalism, which says that only natural laws and forces operate in the world, a naturalist has to explain where this universal belief in the divine came from, and they have to explain it from natural causes. We following so far? Okay? So they're forced to come up with a natural theory, which what force in the universe caused humanity to have this natural sense of the divine. And of course, they go to the all-powerful evolutionary process. Evolution tells us that some point in our evolutionary history, we developed this trait that helped us believe in the divine that enabled us to survive. Everything in evolution that we develop enables us to survive over another race or another tribe of people that we are in competition with. So somewhere this belief in the divine was ingrained in us as an adaptive trait. And of course, this doesn't come from God. This comes very naturally. And so it's an adaptive trait that leads you to believe in something that isn't true. Okay? So we developed an adaptive trait to believe in the divine, which isn't true. You following? Good. I don't want to lose myself in this either. So there's no God in the universe. Your natural inclination to believe merely helped your species survive. Okay? So the skeptics of religious belief say that we survived the evolutionary process with this untrue belief that does not correlate with reality. We've fooled ourselves into believing in something that isn't true. So here's the problem. If we can't trust our belief-forming faculties to tell us the truth about this, then how can we trust our belief-forming faculties to tell us the truth about anything? Right? So if all this is natural, if all this came from the evolutionary process, which isn't about learning the truth, it's about survival. The only thing we can trust the evolutionary process to produce in us is something that will help us survive, not necessarily something that will lead us to truth. So it leads us to the whole system of logic and understanding to break down. If we're formed by unguided evolution, it comes with it a system that breaks the whole process down. Let me give this in a simple illustration, simple enough for me to understand, okay? So let's say you have a beautiful looking car in your driveway and you want to go for a drive to Peachland, not that far. You get in the car, you start it up, you drive it down the road. Before you get to the end of your street, it sputters, chokes, breaks down, smoke everywhere. And so you get out, you have to push it home. And you call the mechanic. And the mechanic comes over and takes a look at it. And he says, hey, this is a great car. It works wonderfully. But the only thing it can't do is drive to Peachland. On the outside, it'll fool you into believing it can, but it can't. But if you want to drive it to Oliver, go for it. It'll beautiful, smooth ride. It'll get you to Oliver, no problem. Why are we supposed to believe that a car that can't drive to Peachland can drive to Oliver? That's exactly what this argument is. What you believe about religion and the divine is an evolutionary trait that leads you to believe something untrue. But what we believe over here about naturalism, that there's no God in the universe, is an evolutionary trait that leads us to lead something that is true. How are we supposed to trust our belief-forming faculties if it leads us to believe in things that aren't true? So Mitch Stokes says, believing in unguided evolution comes built in with its very own reason not to believe it. J.B.S. Haldane, I love how he says this. It seems to me immensely unlikely that mind is a mere byproduct of matter. For if my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true. They may be sound chemically, but that does not make them sound logically, and hence I have no reason for supposing my brain to be composed of atoms. The whole system begins to break down. Charles Darwin had this fear himself. He was writing to a friend. He said, "The horrid doubt arises whether the conviction of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy." This is why Plantinga says that science and naturalism are at war, because given naturalism, logic is illogical. Science isn't trustworthy. Our brains are telling us untrue things, so how can we trust anything they say at all? So Plantinga says it's as likely, given unguided evolution, that we live in a sort of dream world as that we actually know something about ourselves and our world. So it's worse than that. That's not the worst news. Because naturalism has to explain things like love and beauty. It's forced to explain these things from a natural perspective. If the love you have for your spouse and for your kids only exists as a useful trait for the survival of your genetics, it's chemical reactions in your brain that help you pair with a mate to rear children so that your genes can survive. Write that on your Valentine's card next month. Honey, I love you because you're useful for the survival of my genes. Every time I see you, a chemical reaction sparks in my brain that makes me believe that you have transcendent value. But it's all an illusion. Happy Valentine's Day. C.S. Lewis says, "You can't be in love with a girl if you know and keep remembering that all the beauties of both of her person and of her character are a momentary and accidental pattern produced by the collision of atoms, and your own response to them is only a sort of psychic phosphorescence arising from the behavior of your genes. You can't go on getting very serious pleasure from music if you know and remember that its air of significance is a pure illusion, that you like it only because your nervous system is irrationally conditioned to like it." If God doesn't exist, love is merely a chemical response, everything in the universe came from nothing, morality is relative, beauty is meaningless, and you can't trust anything your brain tells you. If you come to a conclusion that you can't live with based on your beliefs, you must go back and change your beliefs to align with what you know deep down is true. Love is real. Beauty has value. Some things are good and some things are evil. There must be a God behind the universe giving all of this meaning. If your brains were designed by the creator of truth, then there is reason to believe that you could actually come to a position that is true. If your universe was designed by a creative artist, then beauty has transcendent value. If love is the core of who God is, then your love for your family has deep, transcendent meaning. Tim Keller writes, "If we believe God exists, then our view of the universe gives us a basis for believing that cognitive faculties work, since God can make us able to form true beliefs and knowledge. If we believe in God, then the Big Bang is not mysterious, nor the fine-tuning of the universe, nor the regularities of nature. All the things that we see make perfect sense." Here's what we're going to do. In a few moments, we're going to take communion. And so the communion team, you guys can go get ready, and we're going to wrap this up and talk about Jesus for a minute. So science is not the enemy. In fact, science will enable us to know God in a deeper way, to understand his creation and what he is speaking to us through what he has made. Psalm 19:1, as I read earlier, "The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands." But what we need to do as believers is to challenge the ideas that come from the philosophical conclusions born out of certain brands of science, namely this naturalistic idea that everything arises from natural causes. Because we know deep down, and just by using our logic, that these things cannot be true. There is a God behind the universe. who has superintended himself behind all things. He is guiding the growth and development of all things. And most importantly, he's seeking a relationship with you and with me. He loves his creation. And even though his creation went astray, we walked away from him, we took the gift he gave and created for us, and we pushed him aside and did our own thing and began to break things down, he is still intervening and coming and making himself known to us to save us. Isaiah the prophet, chapter 64 of his book, verse 1 says, "Oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down." Isaiah is saying, we need the God of the universe. We need the master of creation. We need the Lord of all things to actually come into our situation and save us from ourselves. We have walked away from him and everything is breaking down without him. Would you please just bust through the natural order of this universe and come and supernaturally descend on your people? And of course, Isaiah's longing was fulfilled in Jesus Christ. That Jesus came, God in the flesh, who burst through the heavens to come and be among us in a way that we would understand another human being, to come into our situation in order to liberate us from it so that we could live again and live eternally. The Bible is a story about a God who sparked the universe into existence, but he did not stay distant. He engages and intervenes at just the right time so that we can be saved. There's this little story in Mark chapter 4 where Jesus and the disciples are crossing a sea in a small boat, and Jesus actually falls asleep in the boat and the disciples are rowing across. And when you're the boss, you can sleep while everyone does the work. That's kind of how it works. But Jesus is sleeping in the boat. Everyone's rowing across. A huge storm comes up. And these are experienced sailors, and they're freaking out. They're thinking they're going to die. And so they wake Jesus up. "Don't you care that we're going to die, Jesus? Don't you care? Come and save us." And he gets up and, you know, holy bedhead. And I don't know. I try to imagine what this scene looks like. And he's like, we pick it up in Mark chapter 4, verse 39. It says, "He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, 'Quiet, be still.' Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, 'Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?' They were terrified and asked each other, 'Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him?'" What could possibly be the answer to that question? Who is this? This is God. This is the Creator. This is the one that the creation listens to. He has come. He has rent the heavens and come down. And he is still in the business of calming storms. He is still in the business of bringing light into darkness. He is still in the business of bringing life into places of death.